I should start. I'm going to pretend that Peter didn't come in this afternoon and steal all my material, because I think he's a nice guy, nevertheless. I'm going to save it until after. We'll talk about that a little bit after the reading, because he completely disturbed my whole flow here. It's great to find a blood brother, you know, and that you didn't know it was there, and that was cool. One thing I like to do when I start a poetry reading is say that I bet I'm not the only poet here. Yeah, there you go. And I bet I'm not the only writer here. Journals, short stories, memoirs, right? Nonfiction, novels, who knows? Who knows? So, there are other writers here. But you know, every one of you is a writer, right? Every one of you is a writer. You have a mind, you have a heart, you have a body, and you press it against the day, every day. And you move it against the day, every day. Every day you're given a beautiful sheet of paper, French 40-pound water press, great mark on it, cream colored, you could eat it. And you know, you've seen paper like that. Every morning you're given that. Every morning. Take the slip of paper called today, and on its white sheen write, boldly, gently, with strength if you are strong. Love, yes, write of love. When death, write of dying. Write of sun and stars and dark and morning, of sorrow and newborn. Write. Pain, in crimped letters, write the pain. When all is written, fold today. Give quiet to gone days. Make folded yesterdays. I wrote that when I was 19 years old. It was my mom's favorite poem. All right, I could write all sorts of stuff, but that was the favorite poem. And I had a crazy dream this morning. I really shouldn't say this, but I had this dream that your memory is my sleeping beauty, and I sing to you. My poems, I hope, kiss you, and that remembrance awakes. What language do I have if it's not your memory? If it's not your memory, you wouldn't understand anything I said. It would be a verbal algebraic equation. But I have to touch your memory. And if, perchance, I kiss your memory, it'll wake up and be a beauty. Of course, not all memories are beautiful. Has anybody in here ever been bullied? Has anybody ever in here been 9 years old and bullied? Has anybody here been in a foreign culture and been bullied? And had the culture shocks of being in another culture? Anyone in here been the rich kid in a poor neighborhood, not understanding why they don't like your new jeans? Right? I was in Austria, 1955. Family went over there, dad got a Fulbright, we stayed there. Folks didn't even think about it. They sent one kid to one school, the other kid to the other school, another kid to another school, and none of those schools knew English. 9 years after World War II, I walked by a convent that we bombed, finally killing all the nuns in it, because finally, I think it was during the Battle of the Bulge, the Nazis had their headquarters underneath this convent. And we didn't, bomb it for years. And finally, I think it was the Battle of the Bulge right toward the end of the war, where we got scared and we just went after them and killed all these people. Much loved convent. And I walked by that to school every day.
One-third of the kids that were older, one-third of the kids that were older had no fathers. One-third of the kids that were older and younger, okay, were illegitimate. And one-third of the kids had their dads. That's what war was like, you know. And those are the guys I walked to school with. I didn't walk to school with them. Anyway, it was a tough crowd. Ever seen these war pictures of little kids? There's this one in my mind. There's about five kids, and there's this one, the leader, you know. His name is Big Guido, and he's got this stogie in his mouth. You know, tough kids. Okay? You know what lederhosen are? Okay. One other shock, sort of surprising image in here, is, I say, a sewage creek. Where we lived in Austria, they had all these rows of houses along the highway, and they had a trench behind the houses that each house dumped raw sewage in. Just straight out of the toilet. You know? Once I saw this dead chicken floating down the river. They threw anything in there. Okay? I wasn't rich, but I was rich in comparison to a world where the sewage went down your backyard. Okay? Remember how Sicilian all the post-war children were. A mafia in lederhosen. How their poking fingers bit. Remember how they hated us for wearing jeans and being shocked at their lard sandwiches and rosaries read for the bomb-caved convent in their town. Remember how we hated them for hating us and how we talked ourselves to sleep at night with dreams of powerful cars, the language that we knew. Remember the sewage creek behind our house and the ragtag clapboard fears we engineered across that river Styx that kept us in. And how strange we felt, and how much we looked at the long grass curves that hung over the banks into that oily black water that made them die. Remember the small dogs that chased, scared us home, and the kicks of the gang that kicked us into the ditch. Remember how we went back out of the ditch by crossing our bridge into the field of yellow daisies, and with wooden fence slat swords, and how all afternoon the heads of thin Austrian children fell like flowers. Sleeping Beauty. Okay. We have imagined pasts. Yeah? Any of you have imagined pasts? You get in a tough situation and there's this sort of a dreamed past that really isn't there. And yet it nourishes us, but sometimes it poisons us, right? I mean, it wrecks our present sometimes, but it also informs our presence and makes it rich. Some of our identifications, you know. I haven't been in Kansas in years, but I'm a Western Kansas guy, you know? Kansas steel and stone blues from the city. Fields have tilted vertical and gone to gray stone walls hung with brittle panes of steel-fenced glass mirroring an eighth-inch depth of harvest sun. I am, or was, a plainsman, now white, pale in a world of thin women. Wind doesn't visit often here anymore, and coming finds nothing to move but a flag in my chest, tugging southwest to an earlier place of smell of sun skin and rain pox dust. Somewhere is there still warm leaning wheat, a nodding over long hills and brown knees of girls angling sure through those gold sea swells. Are there quick glints of minnows and slow cat in shadows of trees by rivers in hollows and welcomed boys bringing fish curving wet from their hands and gathered to girls. Imagine past. If you haven't read George Orwell's essay on called The Politics and the English Language, you must read it before the election.
point is that when you write about something, have a picture of it in your head at the time you write about it. That's real true, important for any kind of writing. Or else you just kind of take off into abstraction, really, don't you? Okay? We heard all sorts of garbage about the war in Vietnam. And it was written, for the most part, by people who had never really had a picture of a dead person in their head or, of course, splashed across them. Right? Collateral damage. That means you three are on the wall. See? But we don't think of collateral damage. Nice abstraction, we hide behind it. I was walking down a shopping center with my wife in 1971, and of all places, there was an exhibit of Don Luce's photos from Vietnam, North Vietnam and South Vietnam, of civilians that had been burnt by napalm. And you know napalm, all of you guys, or at least the older, younger guys know napalm? You put jelly, sort of like glue-like jelly in gasoline, okay? And then the bomb goes off, and a big piece of it hits me here, and it burns like crazy, so I go like this. Now it's on my hand. I go like this. Now it's burning my shoulder. See? And it just keeps going until you're dead. But a lot of people live. And Don Luce's photos showed what that did to them. And you know, in war is really a lack of patience. War is a lack of patience. The face of man melts like a candle when it burns, obeying the laws of this other erosion that's faster with men, because man is not so patient with men as with wax. But the end result is the same, a change in the form. The face folds in, child pink at first, it dries, taut brown. In one particular case, the bulk of the napalm struck by the nose and clung and carved in the cheek the whorl of an ear that listens and looks like a free-formed orchid, blushing, or a maelstrom going down. The lower half of the face melted over the mouth. The man passed out and forgot to open his mouth before the flesh congealed, locking the words perpetually in and up to the eyes. The eyes, too, were redesigned. Both lids shrunk when the flesh cooled, the eyes always open and loud with speech. The man will go blind because eyes dry out when open so long and unable to close their men. The nostrils filled with molten flesh, holding to the hollows like soil that clings in island depressions where constant winds argue towards death. Were it not for the luck of the hole burned in by the side of the nose through the cheek, providing a way for the air to the lungs, the man would have died. And elsewhere, away from the particular case, there are men who stand before mirrors carefully combing their hair for the image they make. As half a continent breaks up in a storm, in a maelstrom going down, sunk in the orchid whirl of an ear that breathes through the cheek by the nose of one man's scar whose face is bigger than whole states that sink there. My teacher said, don't put that in your thesis. You know, you lose, you know, it'll wreck your career. And I chickened out. And I didn't put it in my thesis. Instead, I sent it to a newspaper with a circulation of 35,000. And it was published. Keep the image of the thing you're talking about in your mind. It doesn't have to be an ugly thing. Beautiful things. You know? You want to write a love letter? Keep a rose. Right there. Okay. Now, speaking of love letters, I got to give you something that shows you that I'm not sadistic. The last year we were at Holden was 1977-78. We had this great program, Life Enrichment Program here, but it was going to be my last year at Holden. I wanted to prove that it would work elsewhere. So I got, did an exchange at interim with St. Olaf, and I went to St. Olaf, and they sent Gary Stanzel here to teach the Gospel of John. And I went there, and the interesting thing is that this guy in the back with a camera here was he was born in November 17th, and I had to leave 6 weeks later. So he's a six-week-old child of mine. And I'm real close, I love my kids, I'm real close to them. And here I had to leave my wife and three kids, they're all little kids, and this little, you know, buzz butts over here. And shouldn't have said that, should I? Okay. Anyway, my wife sends me a tape, okay? And all it is the sounds of getting ready to go to church on Sunday morning. It just sounds, getting ready, changing diaper, you know, talking, I hear like that. And so it's just this 30-minute tape like this, and then she says at the end, she said, and of course I'm in tears at that time, you know, I'm 1,700 miles away from her. And she sends me this tape, and then she says at the end, you know, in this voice that, you know, only lovers have, where the voice goes down a third, you know what a third is, you know, all of a sudden your love is, you know? And you know, icebergs fall into the sea. you know. Anyway, and so I'm sitting there, and she told me to send a spoken message back. I could, my heart was in my throat, you know, wedged in there. I could not speak. And then I tried to write her a letter, you know, a regular letter in prose. I couldn't do it. Here I was alone in the house, all by myself. Ever had to have a key to unlock your own door? Of course, nowadays in cities, I guess you have to. But, you know, we didn't have to do that. Not in your own house. So it was a very interesting image to have to open a door, your own door, with a key, instead of having somebody there for you. See? I did not always speak. I did not always lean so forward to the page, to speak a word so far, to find you past my crowded eyes, now emptied of your face, caught double in the iris of my heart. It's funny, she's 1,700 miles the other way this time. I did not always have to find a key unlocking my house door with you not there to welcome in with at least a touch of image in my eye, more alive than walls. I did not always have to bear such silence since before we met and merged and married to unfold four more voices to embrace within the ears, deaf, mute, empty rooms. I did not always only feel the head's weight bearing down and table wood beneath my arms and only non-committal clothes against my skin and never anything but air against my face. I did not always miss the climbing up of children on my life with you alone, yet now all hands would find a greeting there, for grip upon my hair, my hands, my heart. I did not always have to arm myself against a dearness that now threatens to dissolve my form and words so far away from being flesh. I did not always hang or live on every word. Now, things are going to lighten up in just a little bit, don't worry. But I gotta do this one for you. Did you ever hate somebody? I'm going to bring this up a little later on. And you can't get them out. They're stuck like a fish hook in your gut. And you can't get it out. And you can't let go of it. Now see, I'm telling you your story. Or I'm not even speaking English to you. You know what I'm talking about. That poisonous grip that we can't let go of. Wow, you know that? Like a bud, this is called holding back. Like a bud, not of a flower, but a leaf. This hand, not of a body, but a mind, is clenched around a tough, vague hope. There is dried blood in the red of its grip, clasped, closed around the promising green. Something is holding back a flood of force. There must have been a winter, winter time, a night in winter colder than its weather. Something, somewhere, somehow was hurt. There was a night of this and that cause, a kind of rain that's blown from the north of your life and strikes your face and freezes there across eyelids of self-pity. Can't a man be sorry for something besides how others have treated him? Can't he take them out of his throat? Must he leave them alive in the tight fists of his nervous fingers? If so, can't he hit the goddamn wall? Must he let them walk away from the banquet of his pain, leaving only him to pay the price? Isn't there some degree of hope in knowledge? Must he, stupid, follow them again into that kind of cold hell where he kisses the frozen metal of his memory, leaving skin? We've done that, haven't we? You know? We've done that. My sister had a horrific divorce 35 years ago. And she wrote, when I showed her this, she said, "I keep kissing the damn metal." She can't, you know, there's no really funny, fun divorce, but, you know, we can't let it go sometimes. Well, how stupid is that? We all got tricked in the Midwest, you know. Go kiss the, you know, stick your tongue on that pump handle. You know, we all did that. And now here we are adults and we do it again and again and again. Well, there better be forgiveness in this world, eh? Okay. Now, you're going to have fun. A fun poem from John Grauer. You know my name means digger, don't you? I think grave digger, maybe, so I don't know. This one's a fun one. This is called Wonder. Oh, it's not now. It's in this one. Let's see. Maybe I should look it up on the table. All right. Like growing potatoes. And underneath there's a little thing there called present at the creation. Present at the creation. And now, in the beginning, I'll just help you out a little bit. You know, I'm talking about planting potatoes, and potatoes are, you know, say, okay, they're like little planets. You know, let's pretend a potato is a little planet, okay? All right? Now, you're going to plant potatoes, and what's going to happen? If potatoes are planets, what's going to happen? Like growing potatoes. First, you dig a trench 9 inches wide by 6 deep and rake in some fertilizer. Next, reach into the bag beside you and select a planet, Mercury, Venus, Earth, whatever. If it's the size of an egg or so, put it in. If it's bigger, like Jupiter, cut it so at least 3 eyes are showing and place to look up. Then cover it over halfway, just 3 inches, wait a week or two until the eyes peek through, then cover them over the rest of the way. Every few days, walk down to the trench and watch for the eyes to become leaves reaching for light. When you see them, it's time to weed and be patient for a couple months more until the plant's purple blooms fade and seem to wither down the rest of every plant into what looks like rotting piles of hopeless disease. Here, faith steps in. Though half unbelieving, walk with your shovel to the stump of any stem and back off nearly a foot. With a boot, press down on the shoulder of the shovel, push deep.
even with the ground, and tilt back. Wait! If at all possible, go find a kid to watch. Now, pull the handle back. Slowly lift and turn. Spill out on the ground the bear, the river, Orion. I had fun. After all that dark and rare, you know. But, you know, Hopkins, great poet, he had a bunch of sonnets called the Terrible Sonnets, you know, and they're these incredibly beautiful, terrible sonnets, you know. I wake and feel the dark, you know, I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh, what black hours this night is wrong. And that's the good part. okay. All right, this one here, this is different. It's called Watching Through Three Windows Before Leaving. And the little note underneath it is, may God keep us from single vision and Newton's sleep. It's a great quote from Blake. He said, fourfold vision always. May God keep us from single vision and Newton's sleep. Newton's sleep is this objectivity that gets all the A pluses and can't see for diddly. There are other kinds of vision. Peter will tell you about them. There are other kinds of vision. And this poem has three stanzas. Each stanza is in a different vision. The first one's a physical, purely physical. No meaning, just physical. I'm looking out of one window of my house, my loved house, and we think we have to leave. You know? And so you take a look out the window. And the look out one window is the physical. The look out the next window is metaphysical, intellectual. The look out the next window is emotional. And in the last stanza, just to warn you, I compress the seasons of like spring and summer and fall into happening in one stanza instead of, you know, normally spread out over. So I'm looking out the window. Oh, by the way, here are your windows. Your mother was the last room you were in that had a door. And we are these spirits looking out these windows. Okay? And what we see, we are going to leave. And if we weren't going to leave it, there wouldn't be a whole lot of meaning in our life. Maybe that's another story. Again, this morning, through this window, everything is perfectly there. There in the glare of silver sun behind a frost of cloud, and there, drooping from each branch, the systematic walnut leaves, shadowing leaves shivering beside the darker, steady, deeper green, shadowing leaves splayed from akimbo limbs of the erratic black ash. Intellectual, metaphysical. And clearly, closer in, through this window, there these turned white pillars of our porch and their bric-a-brac of trim are figures of bride and groom and wedding, ours, before our entry into marriage to this high brick house, 100-year-old monument to nothing dead or dying, but too soon left monument to the continuing play of musical chairs with families and houses all over the world of time unblinking. And even so, this morning, through the big windows, we are watching. Watching everything be perfectly there. There is the garland blessing of early lilacs, and there, as the wild grape leaves clamber over the bushes after the blooms have gone. And there, the grapes themselves, lovely clusters of tarnished beads before the shining tongue shining of the tart burst, and always here and now, the birds filling the trees, like this morning's pair of mourning doves, calling together today into a song which sings, fade, fading, fading, fade, and clearly cleans the eye
lost his vision? Want to know what love is? Lose it. So one of the great paradoxes. The great paradoxes. It's a shock. We live in a world and it's beautiful. And then then you turn on the nightly news. You have a day, a gorgeous day. It's one of the nice things about not having TVs and stuff up here. You get to have the gorgeous days without turning on the television. Okay. Now this poem is going to start with the beauty, just the absolute beauty of life. And then the TV goes on. And it's a shock. It's a real shock. It's called Death Doesn't Advertise. If I want, and Lisa here to Anna, to fear me, I don't kill you. I cut off your legs. Dead people get buried. You know, no legs, you get to limp around in her village for a long time and terrify her that her legs are. But you tend to forget the one buried. This poem is called Death Doesn't Advertise. Death Doesn't Advertise. And this is the good part, though. Wake in peace enough to keep your eyes closed. Wake in so much peace that you don't have to keep your eyes open. Wake in peace enough to keep your eyes closed. Look through your eyelids and see on the inside the color of every human being. Wake into the morning and feel all the points, edges, and curves of your body touching the bed, where it's safe to stay, slow, waiting, as the day opens up with sounds of water tapping in the sink or roiling from distant trains or hissing down white noise from a passenger jet. Well, maybe your love is making coffee love to you. After all those stumbling years of throwing pain back and forth inside what's now a stronger love. It seems it's always been warm folded clothes, raked leaves, stains of new moon grass on shoes, and stars on stars strewn across domestic skies, full of the scent of foods you can take up in your hands, constellations of curry, oregano, rosemary, garlic, cream, and each other. Take it all up in your hands. Such a rich waking in peace enough to keep still and see through your eyelids the color of every human being. Except for this morning. Before leaving your bed, feel your eyelids become a heavy screen as mine did, where from left to right I reread the images projected from last night's TV news. A long line of dark men, women, and children all seated in front of a chalk white wall, such bright spring clothing. See, they have no hands. Remember the various lengths of machete hacked arms that each person so dark raises up to you before that wall so white. See, black Easter candles without flame there in Sierra Leone, just inside your eyes. You guys, I better lighten it up, don't you think? Okay. I'm gonna go backwards here. the next poem I was gonna read. Okay. Maybe I'll do that for a Vespers. that's the green sweater. Remember that one? Okay, this one is going to be different. This is going to be the one that I thought I might do this morning. And maybe it isn't in this book. Yeah, there it is. You know, you go to communion and you get this little thimble of Jesus. You know, you look at it, especially when you're a kid. You look at that Jesus. Just a little simple. Okay? Yeah, you know, Jesus,
is the river. Jesus is the river of life. Right? He's not just a yicky old river. He's a whitewater river. Right? Gushing, remember? That's the line, gushing. Okay? The whitewater brule river draft of life, huh? If you think you can just open your mouth and swallow this river down and not have it change your life, you can forget it. It's not going to just meander through your throat, your neck and chest, belly and sex, soak your legs and dribble on out of your feet. No! You chug this river and it's going to change you. It'll scour your mind, whirl through your throat, shout through your chest, eddy in your belly, lap your sex, flash flood your sex, power on over the edge of your hips, waterfall down through your pillars of leg, and finally, crash at your feet, flinging up mountains of mist you will walk on for days, with maybe, if you're lucky, a rainbow's end in each hand. Now there, I can lighten up, can't I? Now it's going to read the green sweater. No. I'm going to read. Oh, no. I am going to read one called Snow on Snow. My nephew died, was killed in Baghdad, August 13th, last year, the day we got up here. And I couldn't write anything for about, I don't know, 8 months. Couldn't write it. I was writing prose, you know. Letters to be in. Where are you? In this poem I wrote, this year. It's not an old one. It's one I just wrote this year. And we really have to choose. Things have happened in your life where it got down to it. I'm going to die. I'm going to live. What's it going to be? And you have to make a choice. You have to make a choice if your life is going to be loss or if your life is going to be plenty. If you choose plenty, you're still going to have plenty of loss, you know? But there's a choice that has to be made. Snow on snow. Happened in winter, obviously. Remembering Alan Howells, nephew, 20 years old, killed in Baghdad. Blue spruce boughs are weighted to the ground. This is like plenty. This is like loss. People we love become a place in us, a place to go as soon as they are gone. First, there is the grieving, sometimes wailing. Once I heard a cry cross streets of night, fill the corners of every room, empty the air from every good memory, and drop the glass of a future shattering across the floor. Some try to stop their ears with money. Others feel their souls cleaned into loving more. I won't talk much more today. I will go place a new bird feeder on the trellis where I can see it out the window and fill it with this, with small black sunflower seeds that call as many birds, kinds of birds to alight as I can count. I will say that each bird is a loved one lost and found. Come back. I will say that this morning's evergreen boughs are weighted not with loss, but plenty. All these beautiful places filling with light.
loss can fill with light.
I was going to go on a little long, I mean like 12 minutes more, but I am going to read one poem because I don't think I'll do it in the Vespers. And it is a dark poem. Then I'm going to read, there's a really fun one here, then I'm going to read the last poem in the book. It's a short poem, and it's really fun, I promise. It's really fun, okay? But this one here I want to read to you because some of you don't know this about me. Most of you don't know this about me. My T students know this about me. I'm a bipolar. One. Mixed. Which means, you know, I'm the hospital variety. You know? And I have great years. I've had tremendous years. I taught 28 years, you know. But there have been a few times when, you know, the chemistry just goes wacko and it changes. So I want to read this to you because the most important, if I can get through with it, the most important religious experience I had in solitary confinement, go figure, green sweater, the green sweater, St. Mary's, 6th floor psychiatric, 1966. By the way, this was Ernest Hemingway's floor. He was in the same deal. And I didn't go kill myself. Yeah, I hope never. That's a joke. Okay. I remember watching a cigarette burning skin, black, between two deeply yellowed fingers on my right hand as if it was somebody else's hand. I remember being puzzled by two tracks of smoke stains between my nostrils on someone else's face in the mirror. I remember walking my head as if it were on someone else's shoulders down the hall and back for what they told me was two nights and a day between, with tears having run out the first night. I remember knitting my fingers through the heavy steel mesh surrounding the balcony, half glad and half sorry I couldn't fall. The Rochester streets were wet and dark with early November. All day it was twilight outside. I pressed my forehead against it. I remember begging to be knocked out before I hurt somebody. I remember throwing a doctor into a wall and wrecking a room. I remember a little dark-haired nurse who wasn't afraid of me put her small hand on my right arm and say, "Okay, I'll go get it." I remember waking up without my clothes in the locked room, getting up ashamed, but suddenly finding myself inside of God. I remember knowing for sure that I had lost every good thing about me, but believed him when he said he still loved what was left. I remember taking off the stinking green sweater I had worn a whole month when he told me it wasn't the last chapter of my life. Every one of you, remember that last line, because you're going to have a lot of people in your life that you need to say, it's not the last chapter of your life. It's one of the most important sermons you'll ever give. And
God. I had lost every good thing about me. And what did God say? Shame on you? And I believed him when he said he still loved what was left. And that moment was the sanest moment of my life. And I've been borrowing from it ever since. Ever since. I was rich, you know, in my underpants, with a mattress on the floor with no cover so you can't kill yourself. Right? One other good line for you. You know, tears. Blessed are those who know that their tears run down the face of God. That's the incarnation. Blessed are those who know their tears run down the face of God. It's real important that we got a suffering servant, isn't it? Okay, then the fun one at the end. Okay, it's got a kind of spooky title, though. It says, tonight, as always, it is hard to die. Tonight, as always, it is hard to die. Low on the horizon, the crescent moon rolls over on its back and laughs, rocking with its feet in the air. You hear the crescent moon on its back? It's like a little kid with its feet up in the air, rocking. Happy moon. You know, low on the horizon, the crescent moon rolls over on its back and laughs, rocking with its feet in the air, nesting in a soft ring of thick light that glows through a loose cradle of winter-woven black walnut branches. Light snows slowly on the pale, dry grass. Lord, let my last breath be big enough to hold all this and you. Thank you. I always feel as it might have gone all right if my back's wet. You get that stream of that river of water right down there. You know, Peter is going to be talking about this godfather, William Stafford. It's just fantastic. And you've got everybody. A Way of Writing, page and a half, most powerful page and a half about writing that you'll ever read. And it's in clear English. It's not, you know, academic crap. He is so clear. And it's wonderful. And you guys are going to write. And he's going to pick up this theme. You know, you want to write two things most important. Three things most important. You know, first, self-forgiveness. Self-forgiveness. If you don't have self-forgiveness, the word you put on the page has got to be good. Good luck. You know? You know that poem I said by Hopkins? Hopkins sits down to write. If you sat down to write some morning and you said I, you'd quit writing because it's so stupid. Another I poem. I. It's early in the morning, so you say, I wait. Oh, sure, John. That's real good. You know, go make breakfast. No, let's try again. I wake and. Hey, we're getting somewhere. I wake and feel. Duh. How boring. I wake and feel the. You'd have quit. Especially you. You'd have quit. See? I wake and feel. And he goes, feel. And this is what Peter was talking about, and especially for song writing, for the sound. You say, I wake and feel. And what's the next word? I wake and feel the fell. Hey, that's cool. Because falling. And then also fell purpose, evil purpose. Pretty good. I wake and feel the fell. This is in the morning. I wake and feel the fell of dark. not day. The sun comes up black.
Ooh.
But you had to quit. First four words, you had to quit. Writing, see? But, you know, without self-forgiveness. And everybody in here who's tried to write has done that every once in a while, right? So anyway, self-forgiveness. Second thing, receptivity. You know, just sit, get in the zone. It's coming. It's coming. You know? Listen to silence. Listen to snow fall, if you can even hear it. It sounds like a good poem. Listening to snowfall. Got possibilities there. But anyway, receptivity. Don't block, you know, reception. You don't have to cook it up. It comes. Just listen. Especially once you get a couple words down on the page. Keep reading them over and over and over and over and over. And what happens? The rhythm. See? Now the rhythm. Now what does the rhythm do? It gets that part of the brain starting where the imagination is. You know? And then pretty soon, bam, there it is. Next word. Okay. Phrase. Line. Word. Phrase. Word. Line. You know? And away you go. And the last thing is, what was the third thing? Lower your expectations. Lower your expectations. That's why I started this morning in the mountains. Don't try to understand these poems. Listen for one phrase that you want to remember. Last chapter of my life. Carry it home. You know, whatever. Anyway, just lower the expectations, and then on your own writing, you know, who knows if it's any good? Get it done. You know? I have 1,400 poems, and that's not a lot for guys that write as long as that. 1,400 poems. The book that's coming out this summer has got 70 pages. I've got maybe another 140 that I don't mind sending out to public, you know, getting stones thrown. But you know, 1,400, and it's only maybe 110. I think a third of those others, I just haven't had time to get back to them. But rewrite. My gosh, hey, my son's rewrite for me. Read this, Josh. Read this, Sam. Read this. Hey, here's another thesis. And I'm sure they go, woo, get to read Dad's thesis again. Woo, another manuscript. Same one I've read six times. You know, but they help me. I remember particularly Sam gave me real good help on that Kansas poem, you know, 37 years after I wrote it. No, and I had already revised it, you know, 40 times. And then, oh, hey, you're right, you know. And so, you get friends. A community of writers helps a great deal. So, self-forgiveness, receptivity, lower your expectations, and listen to everything Peter has to say. All right, thanks a lot, guys. This has been fun.